An Osho Talk. Yakusan. Straight to the point of enlightenment. Number 2.
Yakusan had not given a discourse for some time when, one day, the head monk came and said, "The congregation of monks are thinking about your preaching a sermon." Yakusan said, "Ring the bell." The superior banged away at the bell, but when all the monks gathered, Yakusan went back to his room. The head monk followed him and said, "The master was going to give a talk, and the monks are all ready. Why didn't you say anything to them?" Yakusan said, "There are sutra priests for the sutras, sastra priests for the sastras. Why do you question my goings on?"
Friends, I have received today from Germany a very scholarly and honest book written by Peter Priskin. A comparison between me and Jesus. It is a very rare man who has written the book, because he himself is a Christian. But without any prejudice, he has been almost a witness writing the book, because he overrates me on Jesus. His conclusions on every point are in my favor against Jesus, and he himself is a Christian. Such honesty is very rare, almost impossible. To keep aside one's upbringing, one's mind, and to say straight into the truth of the matter, risking every ideology that you may have carried with you from the childhood. Even a man like Bertrand Russell wrote that he has denied Christianity, he has come out of the fold of Christianity, and he knows in his mind, in his intelligence, he knows that Gautam Buddha is far higher than Jesus Christ, but he cannot write it. Something in his unconscious simply prevents him. He knows it perfectly well, that there is no doubt about Gautam Buddha being far superior than Jesus Christ. But he feels helpless. He cannot put down it in writing, because then it will become a historical fact that the greatest intellectual of this century has decided not only against Christianity but against Jesus. But this man, Peter Priskill, seems to be of a far higher superiority than Bertrand Russell. In the first place, to praise a living contemporary is very difficult. He is so visible, he is so tangible, his whole life is an open book. As time passes, mythologies grow around the person, his real life disappears, a fictitious life arises. Very consoling, very much according to the masses, it has been very impossible in the whole history of man to praise a contemporary. It is very easy to praise someone 2,000 years before, 5,000 years before. The man has become a myth. But Peter Priskill has shown such honesty in comparison that first I felt perhaps he is not a Christian, because he goes on condemning Jesus, comparing him with me, and goes on praising me. I liked his tremendous honesty, love of truth, capacity to put his mind aside. His whole programming of being a Christian, he has not allowed it to come between me and Jesus. His unconscious would have liked to put Jesus above me. That's why I say it is a rare phenomenon that he has not listened to the unconscious. He has been perfectly conscious without any prejudice. He has been absolutely just. But I want Peter Priskill to know, I don't like to be compared with anybody. What can be a comparison between me and Jesus? He is the only begotten Son of God. I don't have any God. He believes in heaven and hell. I don't have. In my vision, in my philosophy, any place for heaven or hell. Jesus believes that he is the savior, the very concept of saving others is ugly to me. It is insulting, humiliating. Who are you to save anybody? And how can you save anybody? If you can save yourself, that's more than enough. But people are in great need to be consoled that they will be saved. They are ready to become sheep and allow Jesus to become the shepherd. This is the ugliest slavery. There are many kinds of slavery, but the spiritual slavery is the ugliest. You have sold your very soul. Jesus thinks himself to be the last prophet of the Jews. I am neither a savior nor a prophet. I am simply a man amongst you. I am not talking to you from a high peak, from the point that I know and you don't know. I am talking to you man to man. All that I am saying to you is that there was time when I was asleep just as you are asleep, and there is nothing wrong in it. It is perfectly okay with existence. You can sleep for eternity. But it is not good for you. What you are seeing in your sleep is only dreams, hallucinations. If you want to know the reality and its beauty, you have to wake up. And only you can do it. Nobody can help you in any way. I can go on shouting till my last breath. That will not help. Unless you are ready to hear and be receptive. And even if you hear, you are receptive, then too you have to walk the path from the circumference of your life to the center of your being. Nobody can do it on your behalf. It is just like love. Can somebody else love on your behalf? There is one existentialist novel. In some future century, people become so rich that they start sending servants to make love to their beloveds. They can afford it. Why bother yourself all huffing and buffing? The servants can do it. Perhaps that may be possible someday. But nobody in no future can walk the path inside you on your behalf. You are going to be your own savior. I teach the individual. Jesus tries to convince the masses. I don't care about the masses at all. Religion is the greatest creative art in which you create yourself again. You become the womb and you give birth to yourself once more. The birth from the mother's womb is only physical. You have to give yourself a birth which is going to bring your spirituality with all its flowers, with all its mysteries, with all its roses, with all its freedom, its truth, its beauty, its godliness. But you have to do it. I am absolutely against Jesus Christ because he is saying to people, I will do it for you. You just believe in me. I am against all belief systems. How any comparison is possible? On no point I agree with any founder of any religion. I have my disagreements, and they are so fundamental and essential that there is no possibility of any compromise. He has done a great scholarly job, but perhaps he does not know me intimately. He may have read my books, but he has not been in my presence. He has not looked into my eyes. He has not heard my silence. His scholarship depends on the Bible and my books. Jesus is dead, and there is every possibility he may never have existed at all. Because no contemporary source even mentions his name. George Gurdjieff used to say that Jesus Christ never existed. It used to be a drama. Every year people played the drama. By and by they forget that it is a drama. They started thinking that it is a reality. I don't think so. I say Jesus is at least 1% real, 99% fiction. All his miracles, all his nonsense talk about God and the Son and the Holy Ghost and the devil and the hell and the heaven, it is all fictitious. It is created after his death. A long time passed, almost 300 years, when the first Gospels were written. And the man who really founded Christianity is not Jesus. It was one of the arch-egoists, Paul. His real name was Saul. He was a fanatic. A fanatic Jew. He wanted to kill all the Christians. From his place, he went on towards Jerusalem to kill all the Christians and destroy all ideas that these people are propagating. But he was not only a fanatic, he was also suffering from schizophrenia, a split personality. He used to fall into fits of unconsciousness, epileptic fits. So he was utterly sick on the road to Jerusalem. It was hot summer and the sun was burning like a fire showering on the earth. For days on, he went on and on, just on his feet. And one day, under the hot sun, he fell on the earth in an epileptic fit, became unconscious, and in that unconsciousness his spirit personality changed. That which was on top went down, and that was down turned on top. When he opened his eyes, he saw in the burning sun the face of Jesus. He changed his name from Saul to Paul. He became the most fanatic Christian. Instead of killing them, he started preaching, "He is the man who created Christianity." A schizophrenic, an epileptic, a fanatic, a split personality, a man sick unto the soul. But every religion needs in its foundation a fanatic. Without fanatics, you cannot create religions. I am not creating a religion. I cannot create a religion because I am against all religions. My whole process is that religion is an individual affair. It is nobody else's business. No organized church can be in the service of the individual. Every organized church becomes dictatorial, and individuals are subdued, surrendered, destroyed, and made into slaves. Just today I received the message that this Pope, the Pollock, is turning into absolutely a dictator. For the whole past, bishops were chosen by the local clergy. He has, for the first time, started nominating bishops. the election is no more there. Imposition from the above. And he is putting into all important places his own bishops, removing the chosen bishops by the people, by the clergymen of the locality. There is great uproar. It is conceived that in the coming months, thousands of bishops are going to march to Vatican against this dictatorial change in the very policy of the church. It is not going to help. He is putting in every important city his own people who are absolutely conservative, orthodox. And he has come with a very beautiful meaning about the word conservative. It is an ugly word. But he has come with an idea that everything needs to be conserved. Conservative means one who conserves. He has taken it completely out of context. It has been always the orthodox, the reactionary. Now he is saying a conservative is one who conserves. Okay. A conservative is one who conserves lies. A conservative is one who conserves all kinds of murderous institutions. The church has been one of the most murderous institutions in the history of man. It has murdered more people than Adolf Hitler. Its whole history is bloody. You want to conserve this? What Catholic Church has to conserve? All kinds of nonsense, without any logic, without any rationality, without any evidence, what you are going to conserve? The concept of God? You don't have a single argument for it. You don't have anything like enlightenment, which can be an inner experience. Your God is far away above the clouds. I look again and again, and I see only Jayas and his great tent. Sometimes I think perhaps God is sitting on Jayas' tent. But we have looked. Our engineers have been searching over the tent and they have never found any God anywhere. On which cloud the God is sitting? The physicists have explored as far away as possible. Just empty space and stars, but no God. God has been moving away, because wherever man reaches, the theologians, the religious organizations move the God away. In India, first he used to live on the Everest. In the Himalayas. Shiva, the great god, used to live in the Himalayas. His wife Parvati means one who is born of the mountains. Parvat means mountain. She was the daughter of the Himalayas. But when man reached and discovered all the peaks of the Himalayas, not even a footprint has been found. Edmund Hillary was asked the first question when he came down from the Everest, "Have you seen God?" He said, "God? I did not see any sign. There is not enough space even on the very peak. Only one man can stand. If God was living there, He would have been standing all over eternity. You cannot sleep there." Hindus have moved God to the moon. But soon, people were there on the moon, and no sign of God. Religions go on moving their God because it is only a lie. You are never going to find the God. And a man like Jesus must be a crackpot. Without any hesitation, I say it. He simply hallucinated himself that he is the only begotten Son of God. No man has lived in such a deep hallucination. You cannot compare me, Peter Priskill, to Jesus. In fact, you cannot compare me to any founder of religion. I am not a founder of any religion. I want all religions to be destroyed so that individual is free to look for himself into his own being, not focusing himself on some objective God, but searching into his subjectivity. That is only the real spirituality, to go inward. The churches are out, the God is out, heaven and hell are out, they are not part of your inner being. And your inner being is your only existential truth. I don't want to create a religion, I want religious individuals, seekers, searchers, not Christians, not Hindu, not Mohammedans. And when I am gone, I don't want any organization to go on persisting my teachings. Find out yourself. The earth is never without true enlightened people. It needs search, and only a living master can give you a taste. Only a real rose has fragrance. A plastic rose is a deception. And all the religions are relying on plastic roses. All their scriptures are plastic roses. My effort is so totally different and diametrically opposite to all the founders of religions that there is no way to compare me with anybody. I am a majority of a single individual. And I want all of you to be a majority of single individuals. You are enough unto yourself. You don't need anything. You need only a deep inner search. You need only become a meditative genius. Today, we start a new series of talks, Straight to the Point of Enlightenment. A little biographical note. Yakushan, also known as Yushan, was born in 750. He became a priest at the age of 17. Later, while with Sekito, he realized his enlightenment. Once a master with disciples of his own, Yakushan established a monastery which prospered well. What does it mean? Which prospered well? Does it mean it accumulated great wealth? No. It means it accumulated thousands of seekers for truth. It means many became enlightened under the guidance and presence of Yakushan. It is a totally different kind of prosperity. It is totally a different world. It builds your innermost splendor when so many people became enlightened under Yakushan. The whole mountain where he was collecting all these seekers must have become a paradise. So many enlightened people, the whole mountain must have been rejoicing and dancing. That is what it means. His monastery prospered well. The sutra. Yakushan had not given a discourse for some time, when one day the head monk came and said, "The congregation of monks are thinking about your preaching a sermon. What has happened?" He used to give daily a discourse. And then suddenly for some time, he did not turn up into the discourse place. Every day, thousands of seekers gathered to listen him, but had to return back very sad and in despair. What has happened to the master? Why he is not coming to give his sermons? Not that he was ill, he was perfectly healthy. He was chopping wood, the disciples saw him. He was carrying water from the well. He was doing everything except the sermons. What could have been the cause? As far as I am concerned, I know the cause. The cause was that so many people have become enlightened. The master thought that when there are so many people in the congregation enlightened, they will say, there is no need for me to go on and on telling people. Enough people are enlightened. They can share their enlightenment, their illumination, their light, their life. What is the need for me? But the chief monk of the monastery, that is the administrative post, it does not mean that the chief monk is enlightened. On the contrary, the chief monk is never enlightened. Because he has to do some work. He has to take care of thousands of monks. Look at Tathagata. I will not allow him to become enlightened. Once he becomes enlightened, who is going to run to the courts, to the police? I have given him the name Tathagata, it means the Buddha. Be patient and be at ease. When the time is ripe, when I see now there is no need to run to any court, to the police, I have given you the name, indicative that if you are patient enough, you will become a Buddha. But right now, you are the in charge of the commune. Head monks, chief monks, whatever their name, are not allowed to be enlightened. They have to do other things too. If everybody becomes enlightened, I will be in trouble. Who is going to cook food for you all? So many things are needed for 10,000 people. Certainly, few people have to be patient and wait till others have reached to enlightenment. Their waiting is a virtue. Their waiting for others to become enlightened is a great quality of compassion, of love. So they are not the losers. The head monk came and said, the congregation of monks are thinking about your preaching a sermon. He could not understand why he has stopped giving his sermons. They could not see that even the rocks of the mountain are giving sermons. So many people have become enlightened that the whole mountain is aflame. Now, others who are not enlightened should sit by the side of the enlightened ones. Yaku-san said, ring the bell. That is calling all the monks to the congregation place. The superior banged away at the bell, but when all the monks gathered, Yaku-san went back to his room. The head monk followed him and said, the master was going to give a talk and the monks are all ready. Why did not you say anything to them? The fact is, that which needs to be said cannot be said. And that which can be said is not the truth. Every enlightened person has come across the difficulty. How to transfer the experience? Words are important. And dangerous. Much is lost the moment you convert your experience in your mind from the no mind. Almost 99% is lost. But still there is some fragrance left. But when you speak it, and it reaches to the ear of the listeners, that 1% very rarely survives. Because the listener goes on interpreting it. Unless the listener stops interpreting, that means, unless he becomes a no mind. Mind is interpretation. It is commentary. It is constant commentary. It is continuously saying to you what it means. When you simply listen in a silence, no commentary, no interpretation, that 1% fragrance will become a seed and as you go on meditating, that seed will become one day a flowering bush. But it is very difficult because the disciples have to be ready, deep-rooted in meditation, then only that 1% perhaps may enter their being and will become a seed. The master came to the congregation. All the monks have gathered because for many days he has not spoken. But as the gathering was complete, everybody has come. The master returned to his room without saying a word. In fact, he is not saying but sowing. He is saying, return to your innermost room. He is not saying in words, he is showing that don't waste time in words, just go inside, into your inner room, into your inner shrine. There you will find me, there you will find my message, there you will find your Buddha. His returning to his room is a gesture, an indication that you also return to your rooms, close your eyes, go inwards, as I am going. Don't waste your time in words. The head monk, very disappointed, followed the master and said the master was going to give a talk. You have told me to ring the bell and to call all the monks. Together for listening your sermon. And the monks are all ready. Why did not you say anything to them? This is the beauty of Zen. That it always remains a mystery. When the master said, ring the bell, that does not mean that he is going to say something. If the people were meditative, just the bell ringing and then becoming more silent, more silent, more silent. The sound disappearing into silence, if people were ready, meditative, they would not have come to the congregation. They would have listened to the bell, its sound disappearing into silence, their own sound of the mind disappearing into the silence of no mind. That was a message, not to come to the congregation place. But to go inwards. As the sound disappears, you disappear. Let a great silence descend on you. But the head monk could not understand, neither the other monks. Perhaps the enlightened ones may not have come to the congregation. And perhaps the master has come just to see who has gathered. The head monk thought he is coming, so he will give the sermon. But he simply came, looked around, he saw that none of the enlightened ones have come. They must be meditating outside, under some tree, by the side of a river, on the top of the hill. They must have heard the bell ringing and the sound disappearing into silence. That must have given them the sermon. And he looked at the people who had gathered. These were the people who don't know anything about meditation, what to say to them. Anything said to them will be misunderstood. And no master wants to create any misunderstanding in the disciples. Let the masses be misunderstood. It does not matter, they are already living in all kinds of misunderstandings. They are unconscious people, groping in the dark. a little more understanding or misunderstanding is not going to help them either this way or that way. But the people who are trying to meditate, the master showed them a gesture silently and gracefully. He walked back, went into his room. The head monk followed because he could not understand what is this irrational, unreasonable behavior. First you call the monks by ringing the bell. And when they have all gathered from different places from the mountain, hoping that you are going to speak, you did not speak. What is the matter with you? Yakusan said, there are sutra priests. There are priests all over the world whose only knowledge comes from the scriptures, from other people's experiences. He calls them, there are sutra priests who don't know anything on their own. They simply repeat like parrots ancient sutras, ancient maxims of spirituality. And there are shastra priests, sutras are very small maxims, aphoristic. The reason why sutras were written in the past was that writing has not come into existence yet. Everything has to be memorized. You cannot memorize a big book, but you can memorize small sutras. In the seed, so all ancient awakened ones have spoken in sutras, so that for the coming centuries, those sutras will reach just by memory. There was no way of conveying to the future generations. Hence all old languages are very poetic. For the simple reason, poetry can be memorized more easily than prose. You can sing it. I am reminded of a very strange phenomenon. Alexander the Great came to India after 300 years Buddha has died. He has heard about Buddha. His master was the father of Western logic, Aristotle. Aristotle has asked him to bring two things. One I have talked you about, a sannyasin, because the West has not known a sannyasin. What kind of a person is a sannyasin? What kind of individual, what style of life, what is so special about a sannyasin that the whole East touches his feet? So bring a sannyasin with great respect as a guest of the emperor. And second thing, Aristotle said, I have heard too much about the ancient most scripture of the Hindus, Rig Veda. So you bring a copy of Rig Veda. Printing has not started yet, but writing has started. There were few families only all over India who had handwritten Vedas. There are four Vedas. He inquired, wherever he went into India, he inquired, is there someone who can give me at any cost a copy of Rig Veda? In one place they said, yes, there is a Brahmin family which has all the four Vedas, but we don't think they will give it to you. That is their treasure. It is very rare to have four Vedas, particularly in those days. Now you can purchase from any bookstall. Hindus insisted not to print their Rig Veda or other three Vedas, knowing perfectly well that 99% is rubbish. Once they are printed, they will lose their glory. But at the time Alexander came here, there were few families which had four Vedas. Those families were called Chaturvedis. Chatur means four. Vedis means having the Vedas. Those who had three Vedas were called Trivedis. Three means three. Those who had only two Vedas were called Dvedis. Dva means two. Exactly it has come from Dva, the English word two. First it became Tva in certain languages, passing towards the West, then it became Two. But it is the same root, Dva. These families were very much respected. Nobody knew what is the secret in those Vedas. To find a family with four Vedas, Alexander was immensely happy. He reached to the family and he said, I am ready to pay anything you want. And if you don't give me the four Vedas, you should know who am I. The old man of the family said, by custom, I cannot give you those four Vedas right now, but in the morning, when the sun rises, I will give you all the four Vedas. He has come in the evening. He said, that's okay, I can wait. What will be the price? He said, there is no question of price. But Alexander took every care. He surrounded the house with his army. There was every possibility in the night he may escape. Because he is so willing to give and he has heard that it is very difficult to get. They will give their life, but they will not give their Vedas. Seeing that the old man is so willing, just he is asking a little time, let the night be over, we cannot give it into the darkness. They are the sources of light. We will give you when the sun is rising. You come. He said, I am not going anywhere. I will camp here in front of your house and my army is surrounding your house. Don't try to deceive me. The old man said, there is no reason to deceive. You wait. He closed his doors, all the windows, and in those days Brahmins used to be fire worshippers. So there was always inside their house continuous fire which has come from hundreds of years past. It has never died out. They were giving fuel, wood, continuously keeping the fire. In the night, he gathered his four sons and he brought all the four Vedas. And he said to each son that you listen to the Rig Veda. You listen to the Yajur Veda. You listen to the Atharva Veda. You listen to the Sam Veda. These are the four names of the Vedas. And remember them. And I don't have much time. Only once you will hear it and you have to remember it. And there will be no question of asking that you have forgotten something. Because once I read, I will drop that page into the fire. I cannot give my ancient heritage to Alexander, but I can give my sons. So he went on reading and dropping the pages into the fire. By the morning, all the four Vedas were burnt, but the four sons were ready. He opened the door. Alexander immediately came out of his camp. He said, sun is rising. He said, the Vedas are ready. He brought his four sons. He said, where are the Vedas? He said, these are the Vedas. This is the first Veda. This is the second. This is the third. This is the fourth. Whenever you want, they will repeat. Whichever page you want, they will repeat. Whichever line you want, they will repeat and explain to you. He said, but what happened to the books? He said, look at the fire. There in the fire. Four ancient books. he saw they were still burning. He could not believe. He could not conceive that this will happen. He was thinking that this man may escape, so he has put the army around his house. And he was camping in front of the house. But he had never thought, even in his dreams, wildest dreams, that this will happen. But it has happened. The four Vedas are burned. The old man was laughing. He said, you can take living Vedas. I am giving to you my four sons in my old age. They are my only support, but no problem. Take them to your land. Let your master and others know what is in the Vedas. But he said, why you burnt your books? He said, there was no way. I could not give them to you. That was my father's order when he was dying. When he handed them to me, he said, never give these books to anybody at any cost. You could have given me your whole empire. Still, I will not give those books to you. It was a promise given to a dead father, a promise given when he was dying. Alexander was at a loss. He did not take those four boys. Because how he will know whether they are saying the right thing? If this man, this old man, can be so clever, so intelligent, how to believe these boys that they are reciting Rig Veda or something else? We don't have anything to compare. If he has given the books, we could have compared whether they are reciting the same thing. Now there is no point. He told back home to Aristotle that you have to forgive me. I could not bring a sannyasin because the sannyasin refused. He said, I am a master of myself. You cannot order me. You may be a great emperor. That does not matter. To a sannyasin, it is absolutely immaterial who you are. I threatened the sannyasin, Alexander said to Aristotle, that I will cut your head. He laughed. He said, you can do that, because I have cut my head long before. You cut it. Take your sword out of your sheath. I have never been so afraid. I have never seen such a ferocious man. Very fragile, very silent, very graceful. But he said, bring out your sword and cut my head. Just as you will be seeing that the head is falling on the ground, I will also witness. I have left the head long ago before. So it is empty. Don't be worried. You cut it. I could not cut such a man, such a beautiful man, so fearless. How can you cut his head? Who is inviting you? And I am sorry I could not bring the four Vedas, because that old man deceived me. He burnt the four Vedas and he gave his four sons in his very old age. They were his only support. He said, don't be bothered about me. You take these four sons. But I decided not to bring them, because how we will know whether they are right or wrong? when there was no way of writing, sutras came in existence. Very small, aphoristic, two lines at the most. That too written in a poetic form, so you can hum, recite, sing, and let them settle in your memory. So there are sutra priests. And when writing came into existence, shastras, scriptures were written. Now there was no need to write aphoristic style. Because in aphoristic style there is possibility of misinterpretation. And you will find in India a strange phenomenon which has not happened in any place outside India. Every sutra book has been interpreted in thousands of ways. Because the sutra is so small, so condensed, so full of meaning, you can take any direction. It opens in all the dimensions. You can interpret it. You can interpret in such a way that nobody has ever thought. So there are interpretations of sutras, but these interpretations are also sutras. So there are interpretations of the interpretations. Sometimes it goes one sutra has been interpreted, then the interpretation has been interpreted 12 times, 15 times, 30 times. I have come across 1,000 interpretations of Srimad Bhagavad Gita. Such a thing has never happened in the world. Because never so much condensed sutras were given. Seeing the difficulty of sutras, that they can be interpreted in millions of ways, contradictory to each other, and create many schools of thought, which was not the purpose. There was single meaning, but who knows which is the right meaning. When there are thousand meanings available, how you are going to choose which was the meaning of the original? Hence came in existence shastras. Shastras means prose scriptures. You don't have to interpret. Every detail is given. Not just a condensed aphoristic form, but everything that the person wanted to say has been explained by himself. You don't need any interpreters. Yakusan said, there are sutra priests and there are shastra priests. And what is their function? They don't know anything as their experience. The sutra priest exists for sutras. They are just biological computers carrying sutras. You ask them sutras, they will give you sutras. And there are shastra priests, they don't know anything on their own authority, but they can give you the whole shastra with all the interpretations possible. But it is all games, gymnastics of intellect and language. Yakusan said, I am neither. So why do you question my going on? Why do you question that I have left the congregation? Neither I am a sutra priest, nor I am a sastra priest. I am myself. I expound my own experience. And I have expounded enough. I have said in as many ways as it was possible to say the unsayable. I have expressed the inexpressible in thousands of ways. And so many people have become enlightened. Now all these meditators should sit by the side of those who have become enlightened. I have done my work. Now I want to retire. I wanted to retire from the very first day when I became enlightened. Seeing the utter futility of saying, but my compassion, my love, and thousands of people coming with such thirst, I remained. I did not went in retirement, in silence. I hope perhaps their thirst may help them. Deeper their thirst, I will be able to reach with my words, with my silences, with my gestures. Perhaps if 1,000 people come, 1 person may become enlightened. That is worth doing every effort. And now that so many people are enlightened, I am getting old. You should start sharing with the enlightened ones. And this is my last gesture to you, going into your innermost shrine. That's why I have come to my room and he closed his doors. Yaku-san never opened his doors again. He died inside his room. Zen masters die in different ways. They live individually, they die individually. Their every expression is so authentic, so original, you can never predict. Monks, disciples, even the enlightened ones were sitting around his house crying, shouting, please open the door. But there was nobody to open the door. Finally, they had to break the door. Yaku-san was sitting in a lotus posture, just the body. His being has melted like ice into the cosmos. It is a very beautiful ending, the last sermon of the Master, just before his death. Basu wrote, come, let us go. Snow viewing till we are buried. It is absolutely graphic. Come,
let us go.
It's no viewing till we are buried. What he is saying is, if you become acquainted with the beauty of existence, your breathing will stop. The beauty is so overwhelming, you will be buried into it. It will become not your inner enlightenment, it will also become your outer samadhi. Manisha has asked a question. I have heard you say that if we lose consciousness through fear, at the point of death, we re-enter the circle of birth and death. Is witnessing all we can do at this crucial moment, or is there any specific technique? There is nothing except witnessing, and witnessing is not a technique. Witnessing is your nature, very nature. You are nothing but witnessing. Witnessing is the purest consciousness. And it is not only the fear that makes you unconscious. Fear is only one element. When you are dying, it is not only fear that makes you unconscious. You have already too much unconsciousness. Fear only takes away the thin layer of consciousness. One tenth is conscious. Nine tenth is unconscious. Fear takes away the thin layer of consciousness. And you are drowned in your own unconsciousness. It is so deep. It does not come from outside. In meditation, when you are witnessing, you are by and by, without your knowing, dispelling unconsciousness. You are becoming more and more conscious. The thin layer of consciousness becomes thicker and thicker and thicker, and a moment comes when your whole being is full of consciousness. This is witnessing. So when death comes, you witness death. When life was there, you witnessed life. It is nothing new. Death is only an object, just as life was an object. If you have learned how to witness, there is no question to be afraid. You will be a witness in your death too. And if you are a witness in your death, you will never be born again into any other prison of the body. You will not suffer 9 months in a mother's womb into deep darkness, completely encaged. You will not suffer coming out of the womb because the passage is very narrow and the child suffers immensely. In fact, the scientists say that every child is born before his time. 9 months is not enough for the child to become mature. At least 18 months are needed. But 18 months will kill the mother. In 18 months the child will be so big, you will not believe that the mother is bursting. Because to save the life of mother, nature balances it in such a way, it cuts 9 months exactly when the child can come, although it is difficult and painful. The passage is very narrow. That's why the human child is so helpless. No other animal's child is so helpless. Just a few days, perhaps, the mother looks after them. Then they are on their own. But a human child has to be looked after 25 years when he comes with a PhD from the university. 25 years is one third of life. And even then there is no certainty that he is mature. Most of them are retarded. They may have a PhD. PhD is nothing, it is a very clerical job. You just go on cutting pieces from different books and pasting them, and soon you will be a doctorate, a PhD. It is such a clerical job that I refused when I was offered after my post-graduation a scholarship for 3 years to do a doctorate. I refused. My vice chancellor called me. He said, "You are mad." I said, "That's true." You know me. "Why you have called me?" He said, "Listen, for 3 years you are given the biggest scholarship we have in the university. And all facilities, residence, food, teachers to help you for your doctorate." I said, "My understanding about doctorate is, because I have seen many doctorates in the library, all my teachers are doctors. I have seen their doctorates and I have told them that it is all a simple job. You need only a scissors." He said, "What?" I said, "You go on cutting from different books and go on pasting, and soon, it won't take more than 6 months. 3 years is useless. In 6 months, you can produce a new book out of 50 books." My head of the department had a doctorate from Oxford. Obviously, he has written it in English. He wanted it to be translated in Hindi and wanted to be published. It was a beautiful book. The Nature of Consciousness in Hindu Philosophy. He could not find the right person to translate it. Almost for 20 years he was looking. I was his student. He told me, I am tired of looking, but I think you can manage it. Just you will have to devote at least one summer vacation, 2 months. I looked at his thesis. I said, it won't take that much. I will translate it. But looking at your thesis, I can say which passage has been taken from which book. He said, that you keep secret. You just translate. You are not to bother which passage has come from, because I know you can manage. You are living in the library the whole day. You know all the books that I have consulted. I told him, you have not consulted, you have cut pieces. You needed only a scissor and German glue. I translated his book. He was immensely happy, but I had marked on each passage from this book, from this page to this page. He said, you have spoiled everything. I will have it to be typed by someone and I will have to cut all these differences. Why you did it? I said, I know this passage is not yours. You have taken it from Badrayana. He said, that's true. It is difficult to argue with you, because I had brought Badrayana and I opened the page and I said, look, word by word, you have been stealing. So I told my vice chancellor that I don't want to do a clerical job. I would prefer to die than to be a clerk. He said, don't be angry at me. If you don't want to do it, don't do it. He said, I have another offer for you. One commission of 12 students from all over India who have taught this year in the universities is going to visit Afghanistan. I have proposed your name without asking you. I said, you have done absolutely wrongly. You withdraw my name. He said, but why you want to withdraw your name? I said, you don't know. These names will reach to the politicians, they will approve. And my name can never be approved by the politicians. Even in my university, I was hitting the politicians right and left. Even the first Prime Minister, Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, I have been criticizing continuously from the platform of the Students' Union of the university. He was Rajiv Gandhi's grandfather. When he came to visit the university, He particularly asks the Vice Chancellor, where is that young man who has been criticizing me continuously on everything? The Vice Chancellor called me. He said, except you, nobody can do this. Why you have been criticizing? I said, I am ready to answer if he has any question to ask. Or if he has any answer to give, I am ready to criticize. Pandit Jawaharlal looked at me. For a moment there was silence. He must have thought that if he criticizes me before everybody and he has read all my criticisms, because I was sending the university magazine every month to the Prime Minister with all my criticisms of his policy. So he was wise enough. He just hugged me. I said, remember, this is not an argument. But we laughed. He understood the situation. I told my Vice Chancellor, take my name out of it. But he said, I have sent it and it will look very awkward. I said, then it is up to you. I say to you that just to cancel me, they can even cancel the whole commission. And that's what happened. The whole commission was dropped. Nobody is going, because they could not drop me alone and send the 11 others to Afghanistan to study, to see the country and its people and report to the government. The whole commission was cancelled. The Vice Chancellor called me and he said, you were right. You are always right. Manisha, there is no technique as such your being, your consciousness has to transform all the dark corners inside you. The light has to reach into every nook and corner. That's what we call meditation. And witnessing penetrates to every nook and corner. Slowly, slowly, all darkness, all unconsciousness disappears. And if you die consciously, witnessing death, you are freed from the imprisonment of birth and death circle. Then you can melt into the cosmic whole, into absolute silence, into great ecstasy. That is the only authentic religiousness. It is time for Sardar Gurdayal Singh. Duckworth Bird and Whitney Baker find themselves sitting next to each other at the pool side of the Screwing Sands Hotel in Jamaica. Duckworth leans back in his beach chair, takes a long sip on his iced pina colada and sighs, life is good. Yes, replies Whitney, Sapingam his Tikala sunrise, it is true. You know, says Duckworth, I am here on my insurance money. I collected $10,000 for fire damage. Me too, exclaims Whitney, but I got $20,000 for flood damage. There is a long silence. Then Duckworth sits up straight in his chair and turns to look at Whitney. Tell me something, says Duckworth. How do you start a flood? Paddy and Seamus are having a beer in the pub and are talking about Sean, their absent-minded friend. He is getting worse, says Paddy, shaking his head in dismay. Yes, I know what you mean, agrees Seamus. Just last week, he took his dog for a walk around the park and got lost. Well, that is nothing, explains Paddy. It was really embarrassing just last night in this pub. He started kissing a woman by mistake. My God, exclaims Seamus. Did he think it was his wife? No, replies Paddy. It was his wife. There is a loud clamor of screaming and the noise of smashing dishes coming from the Kowalski house. This goes on for 15 minutes. Then finally Kowalski comes storming out of the house. Aha! You will be back, screams Olga, standing in the doorway, waving a teapot in the air. How long do you think you will be able to stand happiness? Close your eyes and feel your body to be completely frozen. This is the right moment to look inwards. Gather your life energy. Collect your whole consciousness. And with an urgency, as if this is the last moment of your life, then go deeper and deeper like an arrow piercing to the very center of your being. The deeper you move, closer you are coming to yourself. The deeper you move, soon you will be facing your hidden Buddha, your hidden witness. At this moment, you are the most blessed people on the earth. A great silence has descended upon you. And flowers of peace and the fragrance of love and the climate of compassion surrounds you. You can see the Buddha clearly. It is your very being. It is you. Witness that the body is not you. The mind is not you. The astral body is not you. You are the Buddha. You are the pure witness. To make it clear, Nivedana, relax, but go on witnessing. Whatever happens inside, a great ecstasy may come to you, almost a feeling of drunkenness. And as you become settled in the witnessing, your body starts melting. Gautam, the Buddha auditorium, becomes an ocean of consciousness without any repose. Collect as many flowers, as much fragrance, as much joy as you can contain. The blissfulness, the benediction of this moment, and persuade the Buddha. He has been hiding at the center for many, many lives. The spring has come. Now he has to come out. He has to become one with you, not only in the center, but in your day-to-day ordinary activities. Unless a Buddha can sing a song with you and dance a dance, unless a Buddha can participate in your very mundane affairs, you have not got it. But it is your very being, so you can pull him out. When Nivedana calls you back, hold his hand. I myself have brought him out by holding his neck. He will come with you. Nivedana, come back, but be silent, be graceful, sit for a few moments, remembering the golden path you have traveled, remembering all the experiences at the center, and watch. The shadow of the Buddha is behind you. Every day, inch by inch, the distance between you and your Buddha is becoming less and less. This is what I have called straight to the point of enlightenment.